Hello, welcome to Hat of Many Things today with me, Mike, and my partner,
Tom.
Joining us today are Asday and Mr. Pepper, if you want to introduce yourselves in that order.
Hey, what's up? I'm Asday. There's nothing much to me about that.
Howdy, I'm Mr. Pepper, or you might know me as Wade, because I was on your other cast as Wade.
Well, today's topic is going to be video games with a subtopic of speedrunning. Who wants to try and define what speedrunning is first off?
Speedrunning is doing a game faster than somebody else could. Not necessarily fast, and usually accompanied with a set of confines. So there are certain glitches that you're not allowed to use, or if you're doing a bingo speedrun, a random generator decides that you have to, I don't know, get 30 Pokemon in Pokemon, for instance. And that's one of the confines for a successful run.
Any other takers on any other disagreements or elaborations?
There's a little bit of a caveat that as well as there's the regular speedruns, there's also a branch called tool-assisted speedruns, which are still made by people, but they're done with like programs and special tools, so it's not a like single-segment play. And they end up tending to abuse more things of being a bit more crazy to watch.
Where does like saving games come into it then? So it does a speed run in total time spent on the game or total time like aggregate?
It differs per game. So on several games that run on PC, you will have a timer that somebody's written for them specifically that keeps track of the time you actually spend playing it and ignores the load time for levels and things. So if you've got a rubbish PC, it doesn't really matter so much. In Pokemon speedrunning, you generally use the in-game timer, or you used to. I think that's changed recently.
They've changed it now, yeah.
Yeah. So you used to use the in-game timer, for instance. But it differs per game. The community decides as and when a community springs up around a game how to do it.
So I've always struggled with the concept of speedrunning because I generally play games less as a challenge and more to relax. I'm really heavy on my RPGs, on my dialogue, on my cutscenes. I personally do not see the appeal of a speedrunning, so I'm probably going to be in one camp here. I know that Wade is in the other camp. What's the point?
What's the point in doing anything? It's just something that appeals to a certain type of person. So some people will try their best to get better than anybody else at playing chess. And for the vast majority of the population, it's not something that they really care about. They might know the rules of chess, they might play chess casually, but they have no interest in becoming the best in the world. For speedrunners, it's much the same thing. They realize, I can spend my time playing this game better than anybody else with these rules. And this measurement of better, the speed of completion. And I can make a name for myself in doing so, or I can have fun doing so.
A lot of people, too, they would have gone, I really love this game, but I've done all I can do with it in terms of the normal metrics. So what can I do personally? Well, let's see how I can do it better. And then there's your own personal sense of achievement of being able to beat yourself and do it faster and faster.
Another thing which is pretty much one of the most important things is the community about it. If you, for instance, start speedrunning The Simpsons Hit and Run, you're going to make 2 to 3 very specific friends. And depending on the game, it's different communities. So it can be a way to hang out, you know.
And I think there's also an aspect of, if we look back on the history of it, as far as I'm aware, it kind of came out of games like Metroid, where there's more than one way to complete that game and you can get to the final boss without all the items and win. So it started off as people just trying to see if they could do it. You know, like you were saying, a definition of better, trying to complete the game with, oh, I don't need that gun and then I can miss out this bit. And then it slowly went down and down. And I can't remember what the speed run time on Metroid is, but it's ridiculously short nowadays.
In a way, the origin of speedrunning comes from before Metroid, though. We had score attacks being the big thing for a while. So you had people trying to get the highest score on the Donkey Kong arcade machines and such. And this spawned the Twin Galaxies gaming forum, which had a whole bunch of recordings of scores. And then they had a time attack mode, which was much closer to what we see as speedrunning nowadays, where people try and complete the game as fast as possible. They had a blanket sort of ban across any glitches whatsoever. But glitches are pretty hard to define consistently. Mm. So the blanket ban of them across all games didn't really make much sense. So another group started up a website called Speed Demos Archive, which was for demos, which were the recordings of the inputs a player makes whilst playing the game for Quake, I believe, where, again, they were just trying to complete the game as fast as possible. And this opened up into a much larger archive of any game that wants to, with different rule sets for different games. Metroid, what's it, not Metroid Prime, Super Metroid, is one of the oldest, most run popular speedrun games, like you said, because it is so nonlinear. And you'll see the same sort of things turning up in old games like Super Mario 64, Banjo-Kazooie, and what was the other one? Oh, Ocarina of Time. Yeah, I've got my notes here.
I would have thought people would try and like Majora's Mask it more than Ocarina of Time.
The thing with Ocarina of Time is it's very broken. Specifically broken. There are so many ways you can sequence break, is the term, which is where the game developers intended you to do A, B, and C in that order, and you just don't do B. Doesn't matter to you anymore. You skip the barrier, or you clip through a wall, or you defeat the end boss with a piece of wood instead of the most powerful sword in the world. Just, you know, things that are not, that aren't really meant to happen due to developer oversights. And so Ocarina of Time has a very interesting progression of world records where people discover a new broken thing in the game, and that challenges a previous assumption, and the times get shorter.
So I think the first time I saw any speedrunning stuff was via Wade showing me the Ocarina of Time run, which I think is it 20 minutes, Wade?
Oh, is this the 1810?
18. Yeah. The one where goes into the Deku Tree and then glitches to Ganondorf at the end, dying, and then just fights the final boss of Ganon and wins.
Yeah. The Cosmos, I think it's Cosmos you're talking about, if it's 18 minutes.
Yeah,
10.
It was Cosmo.
Yeah. That's one of the, I've got that written down as one of the examples of famous speedruns. It's really good. Either that run of it where he fully commentated on YouTube, or his run of it at AGDQ 2013 where he commentated it live. There were two really good speedruns.
Should be noted, just in case, that Cosmo is now known as Narcissa and is now a she.
Yes, that's correct. She is now Narcissa, right? She has transitioned.
I suppose that can kind of lead into the next topic, which is, why do people watch speedrunning? So that was the first one I watched. And for me, the thing that intrigued me was the discussion of the glitches, how they'd... This was not just a pure demonstration of playing skill, as I'd assumed speedrunning was. It was knowing other things about the game and being able to utilize shortcuts that programmers have taken when making these games to great effect.
I actually think that's in a way less interesting than just being purely skilled at the game and beating people through that method.
I was going to say, there's different games. There are ones where it'll be both abusing the game, but then there's also going to be games where it is just pure skill. So there's that audience for you as well. There's that side.
And it depends how you define skill. So if you're the best at beating the game the way the developers intended to, there may very well be a category for that in your favorite speedrunning, in your favorite games community. So one thing which springs to mind is Portal's categories. Yeah. Portal has an out-of-bounds category, which is no holds barred, do what you want, just get to the credits as fast as you can. And it's not very interesting to watch. Unless you're into all of the technical side of it, or you run it yourself, it's not that fun to watch, because it's just a lot of, you know, polygons drawn on screen. Everything looks a bit weird. So for the interests of making it more interesting to watch, they have, the community for Portal has come up with an inbounds category. There are certain specific rules, like your camera and your player, and I think your place portals are not allowed to go outside the bounds that the developers intended. And if they do, you know, your run's forfeit. And it's much slower, of course, by about 50% nearly, but you can watch it. You know, the casual player can see people play Portal really fast, and it's, you know, it's quite interesting.
And why is it you started watching speedrunning specifically? Because, I mean, there's multiple, as you're saying, there's multiple different reasons to get into it.
I don't remember why I started.
Well, okay, well, maybe what's your favorite category of speedrunning then?
It definitely depends on the games. So I really enjoy Worster's long runs of Pokemon games. So his round two on Fire Red, where it's about a 4-hour speed run. That's pretty interesting because there's a lot of in-depth game knowledge that he has to utilize all the way through, essentially. And that's interesting, just seeing someone's mastery of the game's mechanics and the memorization they've done. I quite enjoy watching speedruns of games that I enjoy playing casually. So ones which are very strange to call speedruns. So Final Fantasy X has, I think it's 9.5 hours or something is the current world record, which isn't, that's a long time. That's a whole day's work. But it's much faster than you'd complete it casually. So it's interesting for me to watch, and see the tricks that they do.
And Wade, what about yourself? I know you do a lot of Pokemon related stuff, but why did you start watching?
I used to. I started watching like probably Pokemon or Zelda ones, and as they said, I kind of enjoyed the nostalgia of watching games that I'm familiar with. It was great being able to kind of watch people play these games that I've played before, and I'm like, I struggled at XYZ, and then these people just destroy it either through resounding skill or an execution or through some ridiculous manipulation of the game, and I was just like, well, that's really cool. Through most of the format I've been watching as well, where most of them I watched on like GDQ or AGDQ YouTube videos instead of just the actual just the video run, they're normally commentated by someone, either the runner themselves or someone very knowledgeable on the couch who explains what's going on, and that is also adds another level of interest to it.
When you were saying that, it reminded me of the Final Fantasy VII run, where with the longer games, usually larger skips or clever tactics get discovered every few months or years. And one of the more recent ones was that poison damage is based on the amount of damage that your character can do, and this interacts
as
with
like attack damage.
I don't remember which stat it scales off, but essentially something like that. Yeah. So if you're poisoned, you're going to do an amount of damage to yourself based on your stats, essentially. So I think Pepper knows where this is going. And this interacts with another interesting mechanic in the game, where if you have exactly 7,777 health, you're going to always deal 7,777 damage. So one of the tactics, which is, I think, still currently used for one of the bosses, which I got stuck on casually playing through as a child, is a very specific set of attacks and throwing potions at the enemy until he's at exactly 7,777 health, and then poisoning him, and then he dies instantly.
Excellent. I love it.
Yeah, I think I still struggle with it, especially with long games, because I feel like people miss so much of the game when they do it, but the only people who are going to be doing it have already experienced most of the game.
Yeah, it's exactly that. You very rarely get, I think, oh, I don't remember if it was Karakhan or someone else, but when they were running Final Fantasy IX, they were saying how after they'd speedrun the game a bunch of times, they went back and played it casually, and they really liked the story. But they're definitely the exception. People generally start speedrunning a game because they already enjoy it.
I mean, Final Fantasy IX is a game where it has at least a reward for speedrunning it within the game as well, in that there is a specific weapon that you can only obtain if you reach a certain point in the game before a certain number of hours have elapsed.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So Final Fantasy IX has a reward in the final dungeon of a powerful sword, which is only there for the first 12 hours of your save file. And this was what spurred people to start running. Was it what started people running Final Fantasy? In any case, it was an important thing for people to do. And 12 hours used to be a difficult thing. But as people have figured out better routes and sequence breaks for Final Fantasy IX, you generally get there in 9-ish hours now. So you've got 3 hours to spare just doing whatever you want if you were to run it that way.
So we've mentioned like a variety of games. And I mentioned the kind of Metroidvania kind of style games, which are quite non-linear. And then you've mentioned Final Fantasy, which is obviously very linear in general, but by which I mean that there is a story and you have to complete certain elements normally. So both of those seem to be being speedrun. What makes a game good for speedrunning?
The only factor really is, like I said before, the community. Because you have such a wide range of games being speedrun, like you're saying Final Fantasy is linear, Metroid's non-linear, Simpsons hit and run. Nobody ever played that in even casually. Like, but there's a community.
I played
right,
it
right?
casually when I it came played out. That.
Well, okay, three people played it casually. but there's a community around that. So if your friends, for instance, are already speedrunning this game, they're like the four people on the leaderboards for this, and they're, you know, trying to beat each other's times and get better routes, then you can just casually fall into this. So what have I got written down here? The example's like Halo is not a consistent speedrun. So not even having consistency in the game is the thing that matters. Because when you switch to legendary difficulty, a huge amount of the run is based on improvisation. What else was there? Pokemon doesn't really have huge skips, but people really enjoy rooting it because there's such a huge choice of tools for you to play with. So for a long time, Nidoking was the tool which you used to complete the game, and then that changed over to something else recently, which I've forgotten in the original eras. And for other good things which make games good for speedrunning is being broken. Ocarina of Time has so many broken things in it. If there's the promise of this treasure, of this golden nuggets, of some ridiculous glitch which is going to shave 5 minutes off your time, everyone's going to want to play that sort of thing. Because if you find the glitch, or if you get good at executing the glitch before the rest of the community does, you're going to be the world record holder for a little bit.
I was going to say, like, as a counter example, bad games for speedrunning are going to be ones which are, now, I don't want to say just heavily, but solely luck dependent. So, for example, there was a game, a Cluedo game on, I think it was the Game Boy or something. There's a speedrun for that. All you do is guess straight away.
Yeah, you just pick the one on the left, right?
Yep. You just go guess and you press A, and if you're right, you're right, and if you're wrong, right. That is a bad game for speedrunning because it's just boring and crap.
They end up in like the meme categories though, don't they? Where,
yeah, they do.
Yeah, but once outside of that, outside of the games which are just bad, like Mike says, I don't really think there is a bad game to speedrun, because if you and two friends decide, you know, let's fucking speedrun Gunstar Heroes or something, it's going to end up being
that
fun.
Played the other week.
Yeah, it was.
We did not speedrun that. We suck. Like,
but dude, if you throw me at the boss, we do loads of damage.
When we found out that boss, we could one-shot because that threw you in its head.
It was awesome. I got like stuck inside his collision box and he died straight away.
Yeah, there was another boss where it's like slightly above you, but it's the right distance. We just kept throwing him vertically into it because
stunlocked the boss.
Throwing people at enemies does more damage than any of the weapons in the game.
So you've already done two of the steps towards making a speedrunning route for that. You've enjoyed it and you found out some kind of abuse.
Maybe the speedrun criteria for Gunstar Heroes must be you never fire a single weapon and can only throw your partner at the enemies.
Throw percent. that's some speedrunning terminology. They have any percent for a run where you can just do anything, any glitches are allowed, or 100% where you have to get every collectible, etc. And people have generally taken this something and then percent and turned it into a meme.
So you were talking about games that are entirely luck-based not being great for speedrunning. What about things like roguelikes where the game will always be different?
Ooh, yeah, where it's procedurally generated.
Hmm.
Diablo 2.
So, like, that's interesting because I wouldn't say it's a bad game to speedrun, because even if it's procedurally generated, there's still going to be elements that are going to be, like, intrinsic to the game, like I assume if they were bosses. I don't know the game you're on about, to be honest. So if I'm absolutely talking nonsense, please just correct me.
Well, there are multiple, but I mean, the roguelikes are generally procedurally generated dungeons. So Rogue Legacy is one that's fairly recent.
Crypt of the Necrodancer?
Yep, that one's famous. Obviously, the original one was called Rogue, which is where the name comes from.
Spelunky? That's probably one you've heard of.
Yeah, Spelunky.
Do they have set bosses and stuff?
They will have... I think normally you have to do the final boss, and there may be, depending on the game, set mini bosses you have to do, but you kind of happen upon them by chance because every door you go through goes to a new randomly generated room, and there's various levels of how random that is.
I reckon that people could probably find a way to manipulate that, because a lot of the time when there's RNG in games, people find a way to manipulate it somehow. And that would therefore make it a very good category to, or a very good game to watch run, because it'd be not just like, oh, hey, look, I can make stuff up on the fly if this isn't how I expected it, but it's also like, well, okay, I know I'm going to go through this door and something random is going to appear, but actually if I take two steps here, save my game, reset it, hold in this set of buttons, and then do this, it will actually always take me to this same thing.
Mm.
So it would add that interesting to this.
So I think this is sort of, this conversation is enlightening me as to the appeal of trying to engage in a speedrun, but I still can't quite get my head around wanting to watch a speedrun, if that makes sense. Because as a challenge, I can challenge myself, but I'm not necessarily that interested. But I suppose it is a learning tool for people who want to do it better themselves.
You're a fan of esports, right?
Yeah, and I was thinking about stipulations and thinking that Reckless must have had a stipulation this season or something, because he died once in 9 games with Tristana, which is insane.
But why do you enjoy watching esports?
So, a couple of reasons. One, a couple of them tie in, a couple of them don't. So, one that does tie in is you can learn a lot about how to be better at the game through it, because it's a competitive game, full stop. You can learn how to be a better player. You can watch people with very good mechanical skill, very good decision-making, and take that into your game. The second is narrative. I enjoy the narratives that they construct around certain teams. I enjoyed the narrative this year, as much of a meme as it became on Reddit, of the old Kings of Europe versus the new Kings of Europe. You know, both of these top two teams, between them, held 4 each out of the 9 splits that have existed, and they're going into the final together. Like, I enjoy these sort of storylines. I really enjoyed the NA-LCS storyline a couple of years back when Cloud9 were doing particularly poorly after their mid laner High had to go on an extended leave with a wrist injury. And he came back and said, you know what, I'll take you to Worlds. And, you know, he took them from the bottom of the pool right to the top of the pool. And got them into Worlds that year. And that was just, you know, incredible to watch, and the dialogue and the storyline that got built around it organically.
Okay. Well, I mean, I could see that there wouldn't be necessarily much of that second reason.
Yeah, but the first reason there can be.
But yeah, definitely, there's a lot of that. And if you're into the competitive side as well, although you might think, well, you know, they're playing a game by themselves, where's the competition? Well, it isn't them versus someone else, it's them versus a clock.
Yeah, and that is literally a thought that occurred to me, is that I can understand competition between two people and watching two people compete with one another, but I, when I'm playing a game single player, I'm not competing. I'm just relaxing.
When you watch races of speedrunning, that could possibly be an inroad if you're interested in it sometime.
It could be, but it would have to be side by side. I couldn't just watch one and then watch another.
Yeah, of course.
This person was faster. It would have
this is what I was saying. It's the Games Done Quick marathons, and probably ESA as well. They usually have a race of Metroid, of Super Metroid, where you know, 2 or 4 people have their screens all up at once. I find them hard to watch because I don't know the game, but you never know, you might get something different out of it. And good commentary can help, really, you know.
Yeah, there's some really good commentators on that. I remember
good
watching a Zelda one.
Full stop, especially in even in esports.
Yeah,
that's why one of the best speedruns to watch, in my opinion, is one of Cosmo's Ocarina of Time runs, where he commentates it.
Oh, it's so well commentated, like... It's so well commentated.
Even if it's not relevant anymore, it has relevance as sort of a monument to the state of things at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know the run's evolved a lot since that one, but... Yeah,
oh, yeah, it's been smashed.
Yeah, a couple of minutes gone.
Yeah, a couple of minutes off an 18-minute run, so not insignificant.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Ocarina, one of the first glitches was being able to... At the Temple of Time, you could basically go through without the 3 gems that you needed.
Is this first as in first in the game or first discovered?
I think first discovered, but I'm not an expert on it. I just remember that being a famous one. And then the next time I saw it was when Wade showed me that video, and I was like, wow, like that's insane. Like the difference in obviously in the meantime, people have been bringing down the runs from whatever the first run was to something.
Like 4 hours, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, I knew it would be a few hours, and then they got it down to maybe an hour or something, but then that one jumps it down to 18 minutes, and that's an insane increase in speed. I don't know. I don't know enough about, I suppose, about the meta kind of stuff. I've occasionally looked stuff up, but I don't know if was that just exceptional at the time? Or was that...
What, Cosmo's 1810 run?
Yeah.
Yes, it was exceptional for several reasons. One was the execution... the perfect execution of a difficult trick right at the end of the run. So yeah. If you have a difficult trick at the beginning of the run, you mess it up, you reset, it's fine. You could just start the counter again. But at the end of the run, there's all these other ones which you successfully executed up to that point. And then if you fluff the last one, which in this case was one of the hardest in the run, So him nailing that was absolutely fantastic and very difficult to do. And it was an unbeatable time at the time. When new tactics came out, new skips were discovered, then it was beaten. But I don't believe it was beaten with the same route ever.
Yeah, I don't think it was.
So how about we do a quickfire round where we go through some famous speedrunning games and you tell us what kind of categories exist for them. So maybe if I go to start with, we've already mentioned Ocarina of Time, so let's use that as our starting point.
Any percent.
So any percent. We you mentioned these concepts earlier, but maybe it's a good idea to define.
Okay, any percent. Complete the game anyhow, which way you want. Everything goes. Just get to the end.
100%. The opposite. Do everything. No glitches. Actually, I don't know if there's no glitches, but yeah.
That must take forever in Ubisoft games.
In Ocarina of Time, it's about 4 hours, 10 minutes. That's the current record.
It's impressive.
Is that 100%? When you say it's 100%, is that every single heart piece, every single unlock?
Yes.
It says 20 hearts, all items on the select subscreen, all equipment on the equipment subscreen, all songs, all 3 spiritual stones. Basically, it's a platinum run of the game.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's impressive.
MDST, only medals, stones, and trials. You don't have to worry about all the items and all the heart containers. You just have to obtain all the medallions that you get as Adult Link, all the stones as Young Link, and then do all the trials in Ganon's Tower and complete the game.
Okay, so another one we've got here is no IM / WW. So WW wrong warp, which is...
That's where, how the 1810 one works, right? Where you change a counter because of the limited rendering. Like that's the kind of stuff I find really cool.
Yeah, yeah, these are really cool. You'll love Pokemon speedruns for this. If you so if you look at the original era Pokemon, the 151 category, which is you fill your Pokedex, right? Mm-hmm. If you know anything about Pokemon, you can't do that with one game, but they do. So there's going to be some interesting stuff involved. And this interesting stuff involves quite a lot of messing with the RAM in the game and, modifying when you walk through a door, which map you're going to turn up on and what monster's going to turn up in the next fight and how many Master Balls you have, that sort of thing. So back to the no IM / WW. So you're not allowed to wrong warp and you're not allowed to... Item manipulation? I'm not sure what that means.
That'll be item manipulation. Yeah.
Oh, reverse bottle adventure. So this is where you...
That sounds an amazing thing. Anyway.
Yeah, so there's an item called the bottle. And from what I... Wade, maybe better to take this actually because I'm thoroughly inexperienced in this game. Do you know much about this?
Well, I don't know it fully, but the main gist is you use the bottle to catch some bugs and then you release them and re-catch them and it like... makes the bottle go into a weird state where you can then dupe items onto it by doing some kind of previous configuration. And normally they use it to give you other items that you just don't have before, like the ocarina or a medallion and stuff like that.
And I know there's a trick where you can basically use a Deku stick as a weapon that's as powerful as the Master Sword. Does that count as item manipulation or is that kind of...
No. That's not even a trick. That's an oversight. They just forgot to program in how much damage it did.
So it does max damage.
Yeah. They just forgot to go... Essentially, when you got to Ganon, I realized that this is completely off topic but from the thing, but there you go. They redid a table of all the damages of all the different weapons for Ganon. So they were like, this does zero, this does zero, this does zero, this does one, this does one. Essentially, most things they did one, but they never thought you'd be able to get to them with a Deku stick because... Deku stick is a Young Link item only, and you can't be at Ganon with Young Link if you play the game properly. So they just didn't reset its value, so it does the same amount of damage like as the Master Sword by default.
This is one of those things where we get into the discussion of what's in a glitch. EasyScape is a speedrunning-centric YouTuber who does a bunch of fantastic videos, and one of them is about defining glitchless. So the Deku stick doing infinite damage or too much damage to Ganon is classed as an oversight, but it's probably not something that the game developers intended to happen. It's just something they didn't think about. So should it be banned in a glitchless category? Or these are the questions which individual communities have to answer when they come to draw up rules for a new game.
There's probably infinitely many ways you can do something weird in a game because coding as my job, I know how easy it is to end up with mistakes. And
yeah, especially when it's such a complex system as a video game.
Yeah, yeah, it's lots of moving parts and the chances that something just doesn't work quite right.
We, in fact, Mike, we had a conversation about this a long time ago. Do you remember?
Was it the Crash Bandicoot that you're going to bring up?
No, no. Do you remember? It was much before that. Do you remember getting angry at Charlie for doing the double shot in?
Mate, I was always angry at Charlie.
But specifically at him doing the double
just
shot in Halo 2.
And slap him around the head for me.
Hey.
No, I've not been angry at Charlie. Yes. So Charlie thought that when Halo 3 came out, the game required less skill. Because the double tap, was it double tap a glitch or an intentional?
It depends. The game developers didn't patch it at any point, so.
So there was some sort of action coded into Halo 2, which no one was told about, that someone discovered. I think there was two. There was BYB.
There was quite a few, yeah. There was BXB, which is where you could melee more. You could melee more often than you would otherwise
be able
to. It was
like shoot, melee, shoot, wasn't it? And it would kill people instantly.
It was melee, and then you start reloading, but then you melee again. So you can melee faster the second time.
And there was another one. There was like a
RRX, I think, which was where you fired the battle rifle, which is meant to be a 3-shot weapon, with 6 shots instead.
Yeah, and we had an argument about what required more skill. Halo 3, for not having these instant kill mechanics in the game, intentionally or not intentionally, that some people knew about and some people didn't, so the people who knew about it could stomp everyone else. Or Halo 3, where these mechanics had been taken out of the game, or were never designed to be there in the first place, either way, and people simply had to, you know, move, aim, and shoot accurately. I thought that it was potentially somewhat unfair that some people knew this little combo and other people didn't, and that it was just, it created an imbalance. Because it was perceived at the time as a glitch rather than an intentional piece of design. And it was exploiting that glitch to win games and to the detriment of other people's playing experience. And Charlie thought it just required more skill because you had to execute this little combo.
Which is essentially where the discussion comes to, defining whether something is a glitch or not. So this is where glitchless categories and the controversy therein come from.
Man, that is a long time ago.
Yeah, we're talking over 10 years, right?
Yeah, well over.
Maybe over 15.
Still salty, though.
He just doesn't like Charlie.
No, I did. I just didn't then. I got on with him perfectly fine now.
We've all grown up.
So back to Quickfire, which we always manage to distract ourselves, so don't worry. We've already done Ocarina. How about Metroid or Super Metroid? I suppose is the one you specifically mentioned earlier.
Okay, let's take a look. So for anyone listening along at home, I'm cheating. I'm on speedrun.com, which is the prime location for speedrunning information.
Is that the tagline at the top of their website? Did you just read that out?
No, I just made it up, but it's probably something like that. And I just typed in the search box. Is it?
It sounds very familiar.
I just said it with a voice. I hoped my charisma would carry it. But anyway,
air quotes, charisma.
Yep, pretty much. So I'm on the Super Metroid page now. There's a leaderboard of all the times. You can see that in the any percent, 41 minutes is the best time. Really? That seems a bit high. But anyway, and then we've got all the categories across the top. Any percent, 100%, low percent. This is one which is common across a lot of games. Low percent is not quite any percent, where you can just do anything you want. There's usually a bunch of stipulations saying, don't use this glitch, don't kill this boss in this way, just to make it more fun to watch. Any percent glitch, map completion. There's a whole bunch of categories because this game has been run forever.
Yeah, there's a lot. God knows what RBO means.
RBO, view rules. It says basically nothing. There's a wiki for it. There's specifically a wiki explaining what RBO means.
It's amazing. Let's go.
It's how far down
into the hole. Yeah, exactly.
I thought they didn't even tell me. It just says double nullfare visit route has been classified as the RBO. Sure.
It says reverse boss order, so that sounds about right.
Ah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Right at the top of the page.
Oh, I didn't even notice that. I didn't look at the
top big
of the
capital
page.
Letters.
So you have to go take on the toughest, presumably the toughest boss first. Because the end boss is presumably the hardest one.
That sounds about right, yeah.
I think typically with reverse boss orders, if the end boss triggers the end of the game, then it will be all the rest of the bosses first, and then them.
Oh yeah, because once you defeat the Mother Brain, there's an explosion and an escape, isn't there?
So I think, like, one game that's obviously good, sorry, random interjection. I've just realized one game that will definitely have loads of speedrun categories is Dark Souls.
Let's have a look. Which one?
Any of them.
Go with
okay,
the
let's look
one.
At Dark Souls 1, because obviously 1
it
is the highest
like
number.
Something the Dark Souls community would jump on.
It's,
there aren't that many,
five.
To be honest.
Only 5 categories?
There are 6. There's any percent with no wrong warp, we know what that is. Any percent force quit, that would be something specific to the game, where there'll be a glitch or oversight with force quit in the game. All bosses, all achievements, and 100%. 100% is under the miscellaneous tab, because I imagine there's a lot to do.
Yeah, I saw that miscellaneous was a tab of 2, so I counted for it.
I see. Don't worry, we can cut that out in post. You'll sound smart.
Yes.
just out of interest, I know Dark Souls is a very hard game, but it's one of those ones where you get a lot of skill. Like, it's one of those games where once you see someone who's skilled at it, you can see that they, you know, they could go back and do a run quite quickly. I could see that being the case. So what is the time on that?
So the time on the any percent, which is the default tab, so I'm assuming it's the most serious category, is 32 minutes and 36 seconds. And the last time I watched a run of Dark Souls, they abused the Pyromancer. Because it's broken. That's all I remember of the run.
Of it just being a particularly strong character build.
Something like that, yeah. That doesn't require a lot of items to scale off or something like that.
And it is that kind of game where bosses will have like different fight patterns depending on where you are. So I know that my housemate and his girlfriend play it regularly, and there was, I can't remember which dragon it is, but there's a dragon you have to go fight. And if you get to a certain, there's basically a point you can run back to the start of the boss fight, because that you kind of get stuck in an instance. You can run back there to dodge like his powerful attack that nearly always kills you when you get to him. And then there's a lot of kind of that maneuvering. It's that kind of game. It's about learning. They're essentially kind of, they're not necessarily always glitches. They're not necessarily always programmed in, but it is a lot about learning how specific bosses work. I mean, I'm sure to do an any percent, it's kind of some ridiculous, as you say, some other ridiculous glitch, but for like a 100% run, it's going to be a lot of learning how those bosses fight, I assume.
To emphasize that point, the recent GDQ had a blindfolded bosses run of Dark Souls.
Wow.
Oh, yes. You were asking about types of speedrun. Blindfolded. Now there's something
blindfolded
to talk about.
Oh, so Super people, Punch Out, so good.
Yeah, so this is the one, I think this is the one it started on. So Mike Tyson's Punch Out Raw versus SmackDown Big Tits 3000, whatever it's called. It's very easy to know what's going on with only audio cues. So people played that game with blindfolds on, and the people decided, let's play the game first with blindfolds on. And then they had races and stuff at GDQs, and it was grand time.
Have to memorize the button sequences or something?
Not so much the button sequences, because, you know, one button does one punch and another button does a different type of punch, something like that. But you have to memorize what the sounds mean. So when a certain little chiptune noise plays, you're going to have to dodge to the left, that sort of thing. And it's reacting to those sorts of things without, you know, seeing the interface. So that's cool. People have taken blindfold speedruns very far, with someone completing Super Mario World 3 with a blindfold on, which is a long run.
Oh, wow.
That sound, yeah. I feel like I'm going to have to go and watch some of those now.
Yeah, definitely. There was a video I watched very recently. I'll try and pull it up in a second.
Cool. I mean, we can bung stuff in the show notes. So, examples.
That'll be a lot.
It was specifically a compilation video where someone was like, you know, top 10 speedrunning things or something. So it's like I was saying, recently there's been an explosion of YouTube content creators doing speedrun-centric things. So a couple are Apollo Legend and Easyscape do compilation videos. Apollo Legend also does the state of speedrunning kind of videos, where he talks about there's this thing going on, there's this discussion happening. There's a Two Dads podcast, which I've not listened to at all. And there's a guy called Summoning Salt who started doing a world record progression thing, where he says, here's the world record at this point, and then this skip was discovered and the world record became this instead.
Yeah. His video for Pokemon, yeah, it's a really good video. It's like half an hour long, but it's worth it. It's a really good watch.
See, these are the sorts of things which you might be interested in, Mike, as opposed to actually watching an individual speedrun, sort of watching the output of an amalgamation of them. So these top 10 videos. Yeah, except not King of Kong.
He's the one who just got struck from his records, right?
Yeah, so Twin Galaxies is an embarrassment of a website, and Todd Rogers is an embarrassment of a speedrunner.
Why?
He cheated the entire way.
Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the story's kind of come to a head recently, and it's kind of filtered its way through on my Facebook feed, at least. And he was doing... he was King of Kong because he had the highest score on the Donkey Kong arcade game, and you were supposed to play it on the actual arcade machine and record it, but he did it using a computer-aided trick.
He did an emulator, I think.
Yeah. So it was then edited together to look like a single perfect run, but actually he just edited out the bits where he failed and things like that.
Well, that's not speedrunning.
Nope.
That sounds like a task, to be honest. Just a really tame version of it.
Is there a speedrunning-like record that I want to be the guy?
Yes, there'll be a speedrunner record for basically everything. Like I was saying, Simpsons Hit and Run. Yeah, so they run I Want to Be the Guy and, much more seriously, Super Meat Boy at GDQs quite often. And it's really interesting to see the people do these things in real time, because they're difficult games. And if you've played them, watching people absolutely smash these levels is really cool. Especially with Super Meat Boy, because there's still a lot of messing up. People can't play the game perfectly yet. So you'll see the best players of the game in the world taking three or four attempts at a level.
I've got a question specifically. So, Asday, you do a lot of the Path of Exile leagues, yeah?
Yes, that's correct.
Are they essentially almost like speedruns? People are trying to reach end bosses fastest.
So this is really cool, sort of, for a week. So when a new league releases, it's generally released with some manner of content alongside it. So this league released with a new and harder super-duper endgame boss. And because of that, certain popular streamers and good players were going to race to be the first to kill that boss, because it's a good achievement, right? It's an unknown fight. They're going to need to have a reasonably good character, that sort of thing. But last league, they weren't that interested in whatever new boss was released then, but they were interested in getting to the maximum level the fastest. So that was the race which the community essentially naturally happened upon. And that was completed after about a week, I think, where somebody hit the max level. And then people sort of, they play the game much more casually. They do some crafting, they make cool new characters, you know, whatever they want to. We used to have a much bigger thing about races where you experienced this when you started. They started a race season basically the same day you started playing the game, which kind of ruined it for you, where there would be a league which starts, which instead of lasting 3 months, lasts an hour. And the idea is you get the most experience possible. So you have to know the layouts of the zones. You have to have a build in mind that's good enough at clearing them. You have to get good enough loot or make good enough loot. You have to know when to stop progressing through the game and instead just grind, because grinding is more efficient until you overlevel the zone. That sort of thing.
All right. So that's where a game has taken something adopted by gaming communities and has molded it as a part of the competitive scene of the game itself.
I wasn't around for the beginning of races, unfortunately, so I don't know why they started in Path of Exile. I don't know if the community just did them for fun and then Grinding Gear Games decided, let's put this in the game. But I have a feeling that they were in the game from the start. They were, you know, at least they were on the drawing board from the start, because there's proper native support for them in the game, which is a very difficult thing to, you know, just easily implement.
Okay.
Back in the day, we used to have race rewards. So if you did well in a race, if you got first in your class, you'd get a specific item for you to use on, you know, in the longer league, in the three-month league, where it made your character a bit bigger and gave you some better item drops or something.
Incentive.
It was. So old, really old demigods, they were the class of items, like a demigod's bracer or a demigod's helmet. Really old ones from like the first race seasons are nearly priceless in the permanent leagues. You basically can't get enough money to buy them.
Right. And they've been taken away.
The race season, there hasn't been a proper race season for quite a while. They're planning on doing them again at some point, but the game's gotten big enough that the development time is extremely stretched in all directions. So they can't really design a race season at the time, so there's not going to be one for a while.
Okay. So they'll what, they'll bring them back when they've got more content, when they've got new content?
It depends where development priorities shift. So a lot of this stuff is predicated on the community wanting things. If people are loud enough on Reddit saying, boy, I miss the old race seasons, I want to get myself some alternate art, unique items because they look cool, then GGG will take notice and they'll be like, okay, it seems like the community's focus is not so much on the new content for the new league. So we can do with, you know, we can spend a little bit less time on it and have it a bit more lackluster, but make a racing season so people are occupied and happy about it.
Right. Yeah, and I imagine games like platformers will probably be quite big for speedrunners, I would have thought.
Yes, definitely. Like, one of the biggest speedrunning games is Super Mario 64.
Yeah, well, I was thinking Crash Bandicoot, because you can have the all gems, just fastest to the end. You can think of categories for that very quickly as well.
Yeah, let's take a look at what the times are like for Crash Bandicoot so we can get an idea of how many people are running it.
Let's go. I've got to scroll off the entire list of games because I looked at it for just what the longest runtime was recorded.
There's 130 people recorded on the Any% for the original Crash Bandicoot. So it's not like the most popular game. The world record was set 5 months ago.
Yeah, I would have thought Crash 2 and 3 would probably be more popular than Crash 1, to be honest.
Okay, let's take a look at Crash 3, because that was the one that I played the most. There's a 105% category for this game. What the hell?
Will that include DLC or something?
It's a PlayStation 1 game.
Oh.
It'll be something stupid, like you can get the gem multiple times or something due to a glitch.
Or it could just be like secret items or something. So the world record for this game was set 2 months ago, so this seems much more active. What's cool about these sorts of things is if you enjoy a game, you could probably just drop into the speedrunning community to see what it's like. People are really friendly in the speedrunning community.
As opposed to the MOBA community, where everybody hates you and wants you to die. And
There's a lot of toxicity in video games, or at least spikiness. You know, people aren't as openly friendly. But speedrunning's small enough, and everyone's kind of got the same goal. You know, they want to see a game go fast. Even if they lose their world record to it, they're excited to see someone take the record from them. So you just drop into one of the Discords for a speedrunner for a game and you're like, hey, what's up? I'm new. How do I start? And then, you know, people hold your hand and it's good fun.
Yeah, as opposed to the general toxic environment of competitive gaming where people are very detached from one another and get toxic because there's no real consequence to negative behavior because there's no one visibly getting upset and you'll never encounter them again.
Well, that's where I was going with the... I was trying to draw an analogy to competitive gaming because it is essentially competitive gaming, right? You're trying to get a faster time than the current fastest time. Hmm. But it's a weird sort of cooperative competitive where people are trying to find new glitches that everyone can use and people are trying to... They just want to push the boundaries of the game. Beating someone else isn't important. Beating the game's limitations is.
Surely there becomes a limit with games, though, where it cannot be beaten or broken anymore. Because exploitation has been made.
There definitely is a point for some games where that is the case. Take Pokemon Red Blue, for example. You can complete the game with a glitch in 0 minutes in-game time. And it's impossible. Like, you can't do better than that. You physically can't do better than that.
But this is where categories come in again, isn't it? So there is the save corruption glitch with Pokemon Red, Blue, Yellow, and probably Gold, Silver, Crystal as well, I can't remember, where, you get 0 minutes on the timer. That is literally de facto unbeatable. But then people come in and make categories, and they're saying, okay, no save corruption. So specifically don't use this glitch. And then I think that category has been receiving new routes and glitches for, years. Every so often, just someone will be like, hey, you know what, Nidoking sucks, use Mankey instead. And then, you know, some other cool route comes out and the times get shorter by a bit. So whenever someone says, this time is unbeatable, usually when someone's in the hubris of they've got a world record, they're like, this is the best time ever, no one's ever going to beat this. It's always wrong. Someone's going to beat you.
So do you think that speedrunning potentially has a benefit for game developers as well? Because these speedrunners are exploiting flaws in code or flaws in programming or oversights or spots of laziness that identify to the programmers where they maybe went wrong with things.
Yes, but not in the way you're thinking. There's a fantastic speedrun. I don't remember the year or even the season, but at one of the GDQs, they ran The Mask. for, I think it's the Genesis or the Mega Drive, which was, the programmer behind that sort of wanted it to be speedrun. He liked the idea of people completing it fast. This was before speedrunning was really a thing, so he couldn't have known, you know, that it was going to be played in front of tens of thousands of people. But he put these things in where there were several different run buttons. There was like a jog, a run, and a sprint button. And the sprint button makes you move incredibly fast because, you know, it's the mask. He's a cartoon. And they played it at the GDQ, and they had the lead developer in Skype watching them play it and, you know, talking about how certain things were happening, or, you know, just the development of the game, a nice bit of colorful backstory, which is really, really cool. And there was a fantastic point where they said, okay, so I'm going to complete this level in under a second. And the developer was like, I'm going to be very interested to see how you do this. And they fall into the level from the top of the screen, like they do in every level. And it used a specific attack where the mask pulls out like an ear horn and his hitbox extends towards the left. And the level's a giant loop where it goes clockwise round and ends right to the left of where it starts. So his hitbox with the ear horn extended into the end of level trigger. So he fell into the end of the level. And the developer was basically speechless. He said, I'd never even thought you could do that. That's amazing. So I don't think it's useful to watch someone break your game 10 years after the fact and say, ah, yeah, now I'm a better programmer, because you're already a better programmer. You're not going to make that mistake.
What about people making sequels to games that are relatively new?
So it's similar to the one with the mask. They had the developers on in Skype chat for the Borderlands games. I think it was Borderlands 2. Don't remember if you remember watching that one, Asday.
I haven't seen this one. I would be very interested to hear your take on it.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure it was Borderlands 2. They had the developers in for that one as well. And they were, as they said, it's a very similar thing. They were pointing out all the ins and outs and saying, oh, hey, we're going to do this now. And developers were like, oh, interesting. How are you going to do that? And they're like, oh, my God, that's crazy. So when a game is newer like that, and we know there's going to be a Borderlands 3 coming out, then the developers can definitely take heed of what's happened, and make sure that they don't let these things happen again if they don't want it to happen. Of course, the gamers will find a way to break it. I'm imagining Jeff Goldblum saying that. The gamers will find a way.
It is an interesting question now that I think about it, especially when you're talking about Borderlands, Pepper. But I wonder, it's probably going to depend very much on the glitches and exploits people are using. So in the case of the mask, if you've just ported that to, you know, current day stuff, then the developer for the next one would realize, oh, okay, don't put end of level triggers so close, just as a rule. And then they can go through, they can change that in the code easy enough, because they'll have built, you know, a level editor, so they'll just change things around a bit. But in the case of other issues, they'll be more engine focused, and changing a game engine, you know, fixing up a game engine is a very, very expensive job. So it might just be a case of there's nothing they can do about it at this point, you know, budgetary limitations, time limitations.
I was going to say, kind of leading on from that, talking about, so we've now started to mention some specific glitches and specific runs. Do you want to maybe give some examples of your favorite speed runs? We've already mentioned the Ocarina one multiple times, so maybe we should start with that one and actually explain what happens. I mean, we can put it in the show notes, but like the basics of it.
Okay, so the commentated one that we were talking about is the one I remember most.
The live one or the YouTube one?
Yeah, it's the YouTube one, yeah.
Yeah, that one's really good.
Yeah, so it starts off with some really precise movement to get out. And of course, the consoles, I think it's in Japanese, because the text is shorter, stuff like that.
Chinese. There's a specific Chinese version which released in a very bizarre format, but it's very slightly faster because it doesn't have as much lag in the end cutscene.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it was that version. But so really precise movements to get your initial setup, get the sword and the shield. And this is so you can go into the Deku Tree. I think at this point they then don't go to the Deku Tree, but actually, no, they must go to the Deku Tree. Do they go to the Deku Tree yet?
I'm glad you're going through this, because I have no idea. I've never.
They definitely go inside the Deku Tree, because it's against Goma that they do the trick.
I'm trying to remember if they go to Kakariko Village first for the bugs.
Possibly.
They might go to Kakariko Village to set up the bugs because they need to get a bottle. So they, let's pretend they do that first, because I can't remember exactly. Let's pretend. The point is, I'm still going to get through all the key points of the run. It just might be in a little bit of a wrong order for these two things. So they go to Kakariko Village by abusing a like kind of text dive glitch where when Navi, a little fairy that goes around going, hey, listen. When you talk to her, you pause and your character just stays there. So they do this at a specific point where you're supposed to be able to later in the game use the silver scale to dive and go into an exit kind of loading zone. Normally you can't do that at this point in the game because you have the silver scale, but you jump off the edge of that and press the button to listen to Navi at the same time, which freezes your character. And so your character just falls straight through the water and therefore goes all the way to the bottom and into the loading zone. So then you go through this loading zone and appear outside outside on Zora's river. And then he goes all the way down the river collecting a bunch of rupees, goes to Kakariko Village and picks up a bottle by chucking some cuckoos and getting into a woman. Gets the bottle, saves and quits. So then walk back to the forest, ends up in the forest, and then goes into Deku Tree. Instead of doing the whole Deku Tree, he uses a recurring glitch called the Infinite Sword Glitch, which is where you cancel your sword animation by a text box. So like by talking to Navi or reading a sign or something like that. And essentially it freezes your sword hitbox in time. So you have an infinite sword hitting all the time. They do that so that they can climb up some vines. And if you ever get hit while you're doing the infinite sword glitch, you hover in space. So they then hover, and then using that hover, they can jump back, do a precise backflip and break the web that's in the middle of the map that normally you're supposed to climb all the way to the top. When they've broken the web, they then do a precise sword slash to bounce off the wall. And so they bounce over to this other platform that normally you can't climb up on until much later in the level. So they clip onto that, and then they just get through the next web because it hasn't loaded properly, because they came into the room like so stupidly or something. Drop down, get into the boss room pretty standardly, but just really well executed. With Goma, it gets a bit weird again. They set up the ISG and they clip back through a door.
What's the ISG?
Infinite Sword Glitch.
Just checking.
So they set that up, and then the big door when you go fight Goma comes down and seals off the regular door that you go through. So they clip back through that door and lure Goma over to you and then kind of roll. And so your Infinite Sword Glitch hitbox just clips enough through the door to kill Goma. And the reason they have to do this through the clipping through the door is so that they can leave the room and come back in to get rid of the door. Because otherwise the only way they can exit is by going out the blue portal. And they don't want to do that because they want to abuse the bleep out of it. who is it, Simon? I'm listening, Simon. Anyway, they kill Goma, they exit the door, and they come back into the room. This gets rid of the big door that drops down. This is where they then use the bottle that they got earlier. And we were talking earlier about the bottle being able to use to manipulate items. So they release the bugs, recatch them, and they manage to manipulate an ocarina into their inventory. So then they do a precise backflip into the blue portal and play the ocarina at the same time they go into it. And this normally, when you enter the blue frame, it starts a cutscene. You don't have control of your character. But in this instance, because you play the ocarina, you get to keep control of your character. You cancel the thing, and then they do, if you watch it, they're going to do some stuff that you think is really weird. They like take a couple of jumps to the right, throw a Deku nut, do a slash. All of that is precise movement so that they know exactly how long it takes for them to get to the door. Because once they've entered the blue portal, it starts an in-game timer. I'm not going to know the specifics of this exactly, but that essentially the timer goes, and then once it finishes, it loads up a number based on where you were. But the funny thing is, what they do is they exit the normal door instead of the blue portal at the same time that they would normally get warped off into this other place. So it adds this number instead of to regular the cutscene, it adds it to the door, and then that number happens to reference to the next place where it reloaded. So typically it would take you to in front of the Deku Tree, watching the Deku Tree say, oh, thank you for not saving me. Spoilers, Deku Tree guys.
Whoa.
What?
You know what?
I already said I haven't played this game. Jesus, dude.
People speedrun, they're probably not concerned about the plot of the game.
No. Generally, they completely ignore the story. Maybe someone on the couch commentates what's going on in the story if it's a long run.
I just thought it was funny to throw spoilers in there for a game that's like many, many years old. Anyway, so when they exit this door, it adds this timer value onto the normal exit way for that door. And in the game, that then refers to the location. It happens to refer to the location of the final cutscene when you've killed Ganondorf. So that skips out the entire rest of the game. And they end up in the Ganon escape scene. And then that's not even the hardest trick. This next trick is the one that is the really difficult one. So during the game a lot, they use a thing called a super slide, where you can take damage and block it at the same time with your shield, and you get a lot of backwards momentum, and you can hold it and kind of swing.
Like in Half-Life.
Sure, knowledgeless. So at the beginning of the tower collapse scene, there are randomly generated falling rocks, and he manages to see the shadow of one of these rocks and then do the super slide at the exact right time by running into the place, taking the damage, blocking it, squiggle all the way around. But that's not it. Then he does what's called a void warp, where he falls off the side of the tower. And typically when you fall off the side of the tower, it voids you out after you fall a certain distance, because it's like, oh, you fall too far, we'll void you out, you lose a heart, you get respawned. But because he's going so fast from the super side, as he's falling, he happens to enter the load zone, and therefore he loads out of bounds and just falls all the way down the tower out of bounds until he reaches the bottom floor. And it, like, you just watch it and you're like, oh my God, what the hell? And at this point, he's still young Link. He runs through the rest of the tower. If he hits anything, his game will crash because the game's just like, oh my God, I can't deal with this. And then he fights Ganon. As we mentioned earlier, the Deku Stick didn't have its damage value reset, so it does like Master Sword damage. He uses the Infinite Sword Glitch on that to hit him with a tail. Then he gets in a cutscene the Master Sword knocked out of his hand, even though he never had it because it's programmed into the cutscene. It lands in the ground, pick up the Master Sword, and really conveniently, because the Master Sword is an adult-only weapon, normally you have to choose which sword you're equipping, but when you pick it up in this cutscene, it automatically equips it for you. And the Master Sword is actually the only weapon you can use to actually do the finishing blow to Ganon. But as I say, it automatically equips it because it's through a cutscene rather than the regular kind of menu bar entry. And then you dilly him again and bash him in the head for a sword in the skull. Sword in the skull for the finish.
His weak point for massive damage.
Exactly.
It's not the only time Ganondorf has been killed through a sword to the skull. I think that's the thing they keep going back to. two freaking swords through his freaking forehead. Yeah.
He looks up and he sees the sword coming through his head, and then he turns to stone. Not just his body, his sword's also.
So that's one very thorough explanation of one particular speedrun, which goes to show how much detail there is going into various speedruns and attempts at making more of them and new ones.
But how did you remember all that in one go? That was insane.
Because I've watched the video like 10 times.
I've seen it 3 or 4 times.
With the depth you went into there, I figured you actually did the run, to be honest. Like, that was one of the things you did.
No, I'm not good enough. I practiced ISG. I managed to do it like twice.
If you've watched it like 10 times, surely you should just try it at one point.
Well, I did try doing some of the glitches. I tried to do some super slides and stuff. I just couldn't get the knack of it.
It is very difficult, very execution heavy.
The thing I find really cool about that particular run, which I appreciate, I haven't seen as many as you guys, but it's really making use of, it's not just some of them are those execution glitches, but the whole timing, adding on a number. And the only reason it works, that teleport to the end, is because they didn't like order the rooms sequentially. They have random numbers because that's the nature of development. Sometimes they were building these different temples and dungeons at different parts, and
they
just
ordering
them as they went along. Yeah, so they were just it just happens to be that those numbers work out for this particular glitch, which I find crazy. And that kind of stuff I find really interesting because it kind of sheds the light on the kind of things you can screw up when programming, or as you say, specifically in complex games, they can get, there's so many moving parts that some funny things can happen. Is there any other particular runs that people have enjoyed?
I really enjoy the, I think it's Super Mario World 3 ones. not the usual ones, but the kind of ones where they he does the programming and makes Tetris.
Or makes Snake.
Yeah, well, it's not even the one that was the TAS. Oh, I know the TAS ones do make the Tetris and the Pong.
Yeah, you need to put inputs on both controllers for a long time. So the TAS is basically the only realistic way to make Tetris in Super Mario.
But there is a guy who did the warp, the credit warp, naturally. I think it's like Flower Power. That was a very good run.
Not so long ago, there was an international race event in Path of Exile, which was pretty cool. The Chinese server is entirely separate from the rest of the world servers because of the Iron Curtain. So there's not much crosstalk between them, but they decided to, you know, try and get at least a little bit of crosstalk and have this event where they had the five Chinese players and five international players in a pair of races, one to beat a certain boss, you know, maybe a third of the way through the game, and then one to beat the boss after that, with the races one after the other. And if you died, you weren't allowed to, you know, restart or anything. So it was a case of you have to, you know, play safely enough and try and beat the other guys. And the Chinese players are not nearly as experienced at racing as our guys are. So they were pretty far behind in basically all of it. But at one point, one of the Chinese guys realized, oh, I'm the only one, you know, I'm in the top four. All I need to do is survive longer than the other guys and, you know, get further than them. Hope that they die, and then I'll have some of the prize money. So they started trying to use different tactics as opposed to just going first. It was really cool to watch.
So, Wade, I know you've done a lot of Pokemon speedrunning yourself. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk about that a bit. I know there's all sorts of interesting stuff that can be done with Pokemon. Like there's the random runs where you get weird Pokemon.
Bingo runs.
And then there's Nuzlocke runs, which are, there's a special set of rules.
Do people speedrun Nuzlocke?
I don't know if they speedrun Nuzlocke.
I'm not sure it's like done like outwardly, but I imagine there are people who probably do, like just for fun. I'm not sure it's done competitively, if that's the right word.
Nuzlocke seems like more the sort of thing that spices up casual play as opposed to being a category you'd race in.
Yeah, I think that's what it's primarily aimed at.
I mean, Nuzlocke is in and of itself a challenge.
So, yeah, it is.
Like, it is a particular type of challenge.
I mean, to be honest, the Pokemon speedrun now probably fulfills most of the Nuzlocke criteria because you don't faint except maybe once, although I'm not sure if that still happens in the route, and you only catch one Pokemon. So, I mean, and it's the first one you find because they've now found a way to manipulate the Nidoran to be a Nidoran with almost perfect IVs and first catch Pokeball. Because of course,
talk a little bit about the manipulation because that's really interesting.
Yeah, so in the Pokemon speedruns, there's a lot of RNG, random number generator, and most of this is obviously when you turn on the game, it will start with a number, and then it's going to go through a sequence of numbers. But for the most part, if you're playing casually, you will never be able to know what number you're on. Like if you walk around, it's always going to be essentially random for the casual player. But some people discovered, I'm not sure who or how, to be honest, that you can open up your game, and if you hold a certain combination of buttons, it goes through the start screens in a consistent amount of frames. And when I'm talking about frames, I'm talking about like a 32th of a second. I think it's a 30 seconds. I think it's 32 frames per second, that game. That's essentially the minimum amount of time that an input is applicable because your character's moving around. So they discovered some ways, like holding select and A, that it would always take the same amount of time to do this. And once they did that, they then could go, okay, well, if I know what the start number is going to be, I can save it in a certain position, do a certain path, and as long as I execute it perfectly, it will always take the same amount of time, get to a place, and then because of the random number that I know I'm going to have, because I've executed this start perfectly and then executed my path perfectly, it will always give me the same result. And so they've done this for a lot of the Pokemon games. I know they use it to get a Drilba with near-perfect IVs in, I think, Pokemon Black. And now they do it in Pokemon Red, Yellow, Blue to get the Pokemon they want. And the main reason this came about in the newer Pokemon games is because they changed the way that they recorded the times. So they used to do the in-game timer, as we discussed as we kind of touched upon right at the beginning, but now they use a real life timer because the in-game timer was, well, it was as bad, as buggy as the game was, really. It wasn't consistent in any way. There were people who got...
There was something to do with... So I'm going to have to ask you a question about this because I don't really know. There was some effort to merge the Japanese and non-Japanese speedrunning communities for Pokemon at some point, wasn't there? Did that ever go through? Is that why the timer changed as well?
I honestly don't know. I've done a little bit of speedrunning myself casually, but I wouldn't say I'm part of the community, so I've never talked to anyone about it, online. I assume that they've probably found it difficult to merge. But I believe the timer discrepancy just came up because they were reevaluating the game. They're always reevaluating it in terms of what's glitches and what's oversights. The main one in Pokemon that was up debate was the instant text oversight.
That one was really interesting. So this was a glitch which happened where in Pokemon, the first generation, Red, Blue, Yellow, when you speak to the bike shop owner and he says, hey, do you want to buy this bike for $1 million? If you cancel out of the menu in a certain way, I think it's just by pressing B, there's a programming oversight which forgets to reset text to appearing, one character at a time. So every menu opens instantly, which... in a text-based adventure game like Pokemon, saves a huge amount of time across the run. The downside of it is the glitch is fixed if you open any menu, which means the run becomes an incredible amount more RNG-dependent. So while the glitch was allowed for a certain amount of time, it made the run so reset-heavy and so unfun to execute that the community voted to ban the glitch. And any runs which were using it were taken off the leaderboards, which is an interesting thing, having the community as a whole vote on rule changes, which is something really cool from the Pokemon speedrunning community.
Yeah, it certainly increases involvement and the whole emphasizes the community aspect of it.
My thing, I just wanted to bring up some cool kind of Mario 64 glitches that Wade has shown me before, but again, I don't know how exactly what they were. I just remember Wade showing me some ridiculous stuff in Super Mario 64.
There is some very ridiculous stuff. There's a guy called Panon Koek.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, who does ridiculous things with Super Mario. They're kind of speedruns, but not really, where he abuses the really strange programming in that game to do things like sit there doing a glitch for 12 hours to build up infinite amounts of speed and then explore in-game parallel universes. It's so bizarre.
That is the video I was thinking of, which I hadn't realized was not a speedrun.
It kind of is, because there's a confine. There's a confine that he's only allowed to press A one half of a time, and he's the fastest one that's done it. But I don't know, dude. It's strange.
It's not a real time event, and it's a tool assisted speedrun, which I suppose is a different aspect of speedrunning, which we've touched on a bit, but we haven't talked about it fully.
Tool assisted speedruns are very, very cool. I suppose. We had a short description before, but it kind of didn't really get across how cool they are. With the advent of emulators, people are able to record their gameplay as a sequence of inputs on certain frames and play it back, which for deterministic games or things with manipulatable random number generators like Pokemon, well, Game Boy titles as a whole, you can start pulling off some ridiculous things. Really good ones to watch are things like Super Mario, because... obviously, it's a mechanically based game. You can do good jumps and stuff. And if you can pick exactly how many frames to hold the A button down for and exactly when to start pressing the A button, it's going to be an interesting thing to watch when you play it back in real time.
I mean, I think the thing I found really interesting about that Super Mario 64 one is that, again, as I've said, the thing that appeals to me are these kind of glitches more than just watching someone play something very fast. And that's the one where you can just about see it in the thumbnail for the YouTube video, but I'm pretty certain it's something like Mario 64. Essentially, it's like it has multiple copies of the world, but only one of them is like properly populated, and then all the others are weird. So like,
but then one fourth of them are walkable because they're quad parallel universes. Oh god.
It's like it's complete, like, and now I'm going to do video game quantum mechanics. Here you go. And you're like,
What
does you that sit mean? Down, you're like, how do you complete a level with one half of an A press? What's one half of a button press? And then you watch the video and you're like, my mind has been expanded to horizons I never wanted to know existed.
Yeah, I think the fun thing about TASes is that they, whereas when you're watching a normal speedrunner, you're like, oh, that exploits the game. Then you watch a TAS and you're like, oh my god, that really exploits the game, because they could do things that people can't possibly do. I mean, they do at AGDQ, which I realize is a big event we haven't talked about at all. It's a huge speedrunning event
they do every year.
Oh, but we haven't actually mentioned what it is.
It's true.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant, is we haven't really mentioned it directly.
Explored what it is.
Yeah. Big speedrunning event. Runs for like 2 weeks and it's all done for charity.
Yeah.
And it's really fun. But they often do a task block. And one of their task blocks, they got The Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, to live stream Twitch. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, is the things they could do with the TASes are just so much fun to watch. Whether it's just doing a game really quickly, or whether it's just like, you know what, this game wasn't programmed well enough, let's program a different game into it. It's just stupid. So that's what TASes are always fun for. Task block is always a highlight for me.
I'm assuming it's a highlight because it is just seeing these absolutely ridiculous things people can pull off, because, as you say, sometimes you can literally code a whole other game into a game.
Yeah.
It's exactly that. There's nothing really useful to be gleaned from watching a tool-assisted speedrun most of the time, because the whole point of a tool-assisted speedrun is to do things that humans can't. If humans can do it, then humans will. So, you know, you're not going to pick up a cool new strategy for beating a level. You're going to pick up a cool new strategy for breaking a video game entirely.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
Before we wrapped up entirely, I wanted to point out that there's been a focus over the last year, maybe, of putting out higher quality content from the speedrunning community. So people making good YouTube videos and tutorials for things that aren't just text dumps in Pastebin. It's much easier to get into speedrunning, and it's also much easier to sort of enjoy speedrunning as a sideline, watching compilation videos as opposed to having to find a speedrunner you're interested in and watch 10 hours of them playing the same opening to a game.
Yeah, and I mean, it's always nice when things like that are more accessible. I feel like I wouldn't have had the in that I've had if it weren't for knowing Wade, who was already like deep in the lore of speedrunning when I lived with him. So it's nice to see that they're doing stuff like that, because, you know, it's always, how else are people going to find these things?
IGN's doing a thing recently where they steal people's world record videos and post them on their own channel. They ask permission, but they get all the ad revenue. It's a bit mean. But in any case, IGN posting videos on their official YouTube of, you know, Doom 2016 completed in 30 minutes. It's coming into the limelight.
They posted Torje's Ocarina of Time one recently, I think. Because the world record is currently fought between him and a guy called Skater.
I'm not sure how I feel about it, because it brings exposure to the community and that, but the people that are actually putting the work in aren't really getting anything for it. It's kind of sad.
So they don't get any compensation for the ad revenue that IGN get?
Yeah, basically, IGN is being corporate about it, and they're making money as cheaply as they can, which, whatever, fair enough, like, you can, but it's just a bit mean. I don't know. It's something I have to see play out for a couple more months before I actually have a real opinion.
That often happens, right, when you go from something being a very small community-led thing to being, you know, people starting to want to make money off it, and often these kind of things happen. We've seen it before with other YouTube channels, you know, people copy and pasting their content all over the place, which is a shame, and hopefully it works out better this time around for those people. But as you say, we don't really know enough about it yet.
We're in an interesting time.
Mm. May you live an interesting time.
No, please.
No. What would you do? It's interesting enough. Okay, cool. So shall we move on to picking our next topic? Okay. And our next topic is going to be science.
Science. Ooh.
That is very specific.
We have some subcategories for science. So I assume we're
probably
not
use one of them. A generic introduction to science would be very
difficult. Hey guys, do you know what science is?
What is the scientific method?
Scientific and cooperative information on everything and nothing in the cosmos and Earth.
Try science near you today.
For just $1.99.
We have 5 in this category. We've got transhumanism as our next topic.
Excellent.
And I believe we already have a potential guest lined up.
Yeah, Ollie did his degree in cybernetics, so he's probably the man to talk to. And Leah is an evolutionary biologist, so that might also be a relevant guest.
You guys, is there anything... obviously, thank you very much for coming on and chatting with us. But is there anything you want to plug that you've done? Have you done any speedruns, or is there anything you'd like to share about yourselves?
Pepper, go for it.
No. I mean, like, I've done a couple, but they're not recorded. They're not online. I just do it for my own fun.
Are you still doing a PoE stream, Asda?
Yeah, what's up? I'm Asda. I'm unemployed and worthless, so I've been doing nearly back-to-back 24-hour streams of Path of Exile.
So, mate, ditto. I know the feels.
Yeah, this is a recent development. He's not always been unemployed.
No, I quite enjoy being employed, but I've got a lot of savings, so now I'm worthless. It's fine. So yeah, come check me out on twitch.tv/AsdayAsman. It'll be a good old time.
You can find that link in the show notes.
Let's say a good old time. Are you actually a Flintstone streamer?
I do move my chair around with my feet.
Yes, then.
Dabba do.
Get this yabba dabba done.
Just before we say goodbye, we'll do our normal plugging. So please come and find us on patreon.com/TTSS. And also you can go to howtomanythings.com to find the show notes and look up our previous shows. And then if you are a fan of the fact that we have fairly decent recording setup, we'd like to give a shout out to Craig, which is our recording bot that we've been using, allows us to record all of the individual channels really easily. And it's free. The guy who makes it is pretty great. And he has a YouTube channel that I'll put in the link in the show notes. And I've actually done a few YouTube videos with him now. And you guys would probably want to get on his Discord server, because he does democracy Let's Plays. So he's coded. So it's old games. I think he's doing Super Mario World. And that's the one I did. And he's basically coded up. I don't know if he's picking back on something, but it uses one of the emulators. I can't remember which. Anyway, the exact detail is not important. It's all on his server. But he uses one of the SNES emulators and the networking protocol, and basically, like, it connects all of you as players to one game, one playthrough of Super Mario World, and then the action the Mario takes is the average action of all of your controller inputs at the same time.
So it's like a more intimate version of Twitch Plays Pokemon.
Yeah, a more intimate, and it's live with actual controllers when you record it. And that was a lot of fun. I think he does a maximum of 6 players at a time. But that was fun. And I would recommend doing that if you've got the time and access to an emulator and a controller. It's pretty easy to do. So I can send you a link to his... I can invite you over to his Discord if you guys are interested in doing that. So
yeah, that sounds like an interesting use of my time.
Thank you for joining us on Hat Many Things with our guests Wade and Asde, also known as Pepper and Adam. I don't know why I did that with one using a real name and then the other way around again. Yeah, so thank you to Adam and Wade for joining us, and thank you all for listening, wherever you may be. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and tune in next time for transhumanism, a wildly different subject.
And that's the whole point of drawing things from a hat.
Thanks, Captain Obvious.
Well, maybe we've done it before where we... this will all get cut because I am not with it today, sorry. I am with it, but two late nights of camping and lots of beer.
And so, plenty of excuses afterwards.
Well, I have a pint of dark and stormy again, so yeah.
I am dual-wielding cups of tea.
I appear to have a jar of mango chutney in front of me.
You're doing quins.
Sorry, again, I'm still a bit all over the place. I'm taking a while to articulate myself today.
This is why Mike's the host.
Well, Mike is better at hosting. This is true. It's fine. The magic of editing, this will sound so smooth.
I already sound smooth.
You do sound really smooth.
Swiggity swooty, I'm coming for the booty.
Expensive audio equipment, it happens.
It's not just your natural voice.
No, it's so much post-processing. I actually have a squeaky high-pitched voice.
He actually just types really quickly and has somebody sat next to him who recites his lines.
No, I type so quickly that this sound that you're hearing now is actually the rhythm of the keys. I'm typing so fast.
That's a talent.